Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. It's October 1. Happy birthday, Steuben Gilman Granger, my dad, who would have been 95 today. Beautiful weekend here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, particularly today.
Spectacular day today.
Yeah.
Great bike ride.
Great bike ride. All-time bike ride. So yesterday was Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur is a fast day in the Jewish religion. I was out there at Old Westbury Hebrew Congregation, which is the temple where my parents were members, and met my brother out there. We were there for the service, and sort of a funny thing happened.
In the service.
If there's such a thing as a funny thing. So again, you're talking about one of the high holy days in the Jewish religion.
A solemn occasion.
Yes, very solemn occasion. And basically our temple, or the temple, my parents' temple, like many other temples, get a full house on that day. And perhaps that day in Rosh Hashanah and no other. And yet the temple has to be built to house that group, the group that's going to show up on Yom Kippur. And they're there fasting, as I said, and it's a very solemn occasion.
Well, explain what fasting is.
Fasting means you can't eat or drink for 24 hours.
Right, sundown to sundown.
Sundown, in this case, of Friday to sundown of Saturday.
So you don't drink anything.
You don't eat.
Don't put anything in your mouth for 24 hours.
Right. So, and it's a little challenging because there's a lot of standing during the ceremony. There's not a getting up and sitting down. There are many older parishioners, and it's a long day. So in any event, we're there, my brother and I, for a couple, 3 hours. And in particular, we're staying for a particular service, the Yisker service that's supposed to start at 1:30. So we're sort of focused on that. We've been there for a while by then. And full house. And as it gets to be 1 o'clock, 1:15, and the group is still pretty strong. Suddenly, while we're all standing, a woman yells, "Call 911!" And there's, a lot of moving around, jumping around, if not shouting. And apparently, someone has passed out who's toward the center of the temple.
Collapsed.
We can't see it, but that's clearly what's happened. Someone's collapsed. And first, you just hear the 911, someone's collapsed. And then the rabbi makes the fateful statement, "Is there a doctor in the house?"
Of course.
Well, if you're an Old Westbury Hebrew congregation, you say, "Well, is there a doctor in the house?" There's a stampede, and now we're really out of control. So it feels like every third parishioner is heading toward the center of the temple to rush to the aid of this person who apparently has passed out. So now people are flying all over the place, and they rush to his aid. And if you're a veteran parishioner like myself and like my brother, you say to yourself in the back of your mind, you know, sometimes people just pass out, especially older people.
From dehydration, even, and lack of eating.
Right. Yeah. So, but notwithstanding that, you hear these shouts for get the defibrillator, you also hear the shouts for get the orange juice. And sure enough, it turns out it's an orange juice situation. And you can see through the throng or whatever that, in fact, the orange juice makes its way to the fellow who passed out, and he's starting to revive. The problem is this. The problem is once you get the shout, call 911, someone does that because everyone's got their phones. And just as if you think we're going to pull out of it, who arrives but the cavalry?
Right.
The cavalry in the form of the local police and ambulance corps who come busting in the side door of the temple with all the equipment you can possibly imagine. I mean, it looks like they were ready to cut limbs from a tree or something like that. But in fact, they're there with a portable stretcher or whatever, and they're wheeling in and they're moving everything out of their way, and they're kind of pushing people subtly out of the way and rearranging everything. Now you have full chaos in the middle of the temple. And the rabbi looks at this, and everything's kind of breaking out in sort of a crazy way. And he's got news that the person, who, by the way, also is a doctor, is probably recovering. And the rabbi says what many rabbis would say in this situation. He says, "Please turn to page 598 of your prayer books. In other words,
this is all going on.
This is all going on.
And he says,
it's full chaos. We're going to go on.
To the surface.
And the reason he does this, and I'm sure he's informed by the fact that he thinks the fellow's okay, but the reason he does this too, without any comment, which probably was a mistake, he probably should have said something like, we all know the person's okay. We understand that we've been thinking these deep thoughts. We want to take advantage of the prayer mode we're all in, and we're thinking about X and Y. Let's continue. He doesn't, that's not in his skill set. He just says, let's go to page 598. And the reason, what's driving him is he's got a schedule. We've got a bus to catch. I mean, you've got to finish this particular service, and there is Yiskor, and there's Musaf, and there's Marv, and there's Nila.
There's all these other services.
It's got to happen. The trains are going to leave the station. He's not going to let this station be late.
Because it's got to end on time.
On sundown, or else people are angry. Because they're hungry, and they want the fast to end at the right time. They want to get home to eat.
Break the fast.
So we are treated to the spectacle of continuing to read, as a group, in Hebrew, page 598, while all heck is breaking loose in the middle of the temple, and the local constabulary is doing all they can to wheel this protesting parishioner out of the temple.
So it was a surprisingly eventful, exciting...
I couldn't help but think I was in the middle of an Isaac Bashevis Singer short story, and perhaps I'll write this story up sometime, but it was a memorable Yom Kippur.
Okay.
You were going to say something about Leonardo.
Leonardo, right. Sure. First of all, on the front of one section of the Wall Street Journal, big article basically promoting the new book by Walter Isaacson about Leonardo.
Right.
Stating that, you know, maybe it wasn't so much about being a genius as being incredibly creative and observacious, etc. And he does mention the great story where Leonardo actually, when he writes to, and he's about just around 30 years old at the time, he writes to the Duke of Milan looking for a job. And he says, you know, I can do this for you, I can do that for you. I'm an engineer. I can build this. I can build bridges. I can do military installations. I can do all this. The very last thing he mentions is that he could do paintings. So it's interesting to kind of
probably a lot of interest in the particular job he was looking for. Didn't really care about that.
Not for him. He saw himself as, you know, an inventor.
Yeah, all right.
But anyway, also speaking of Leonardo, there's a excitement about a possible sketch that might be of what they're calling a nude Mona Lisa, might be by Leonardo or partially by Leonardo.
Well, you have to think that if the Mona Lisa caused a fuss, a nude Mona Lisa is going to be that much more popular.
Well, there have always been rumors about a nude Mona Lisa because there are many sort of copies. There are many versions done by other people citing this Leonardo. So people are thinking there must be a Leonardo somewhere. Anyway, the Condé Museum, which is just outside of Paris, or on the north side of Paris, is mounting a big exhibition in a couple years, 2019, in honor of Leonardo's the 500th anniversary of his death. And so they're kind of excited about the prospect of being able to show something newly discovered that is by him. Jury's still out. They're not even going to announce. They're having all kinds of research done. And you can do great things with computer research now, in addition to a connoisseur's eye. But right now people are saying, you know, the hatching on the upper part, clearly done by a right-handed person.
Oh, really?
We know that Leonardo was left-handed. So, you know, who knows? But, you know, stay tuned until 2019.
Okay. Well, a big story this week was college basketball scandal. And for at least 24 hours, maybe 36 hours, it took everything off the front page. And that's a big deal these days. It's hard to crowd everything out of the front page. And the college basketball scandal is a little hard to understand, at least it was for me. I mean, there were a lot of headlines about all these terrible things going on, payments being made involving agents, involving Adidas, involving players, involving universities. And what you had was the story breaking because it was being laid out by the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District with diagrams about all the criminal violations involved. And you had a lot of hand-wringing, including just typical of everybody else. New York Times in their editorial, the way they put it was, with a series of federal bribery and fraud charges, prosecutors are now treating shady dealings such as this as what they are, corruption, not merely a violation of the NCAA rules.
So you're going to tell us what the scandal is?
Well, I'm going to tell you what the scandal is, but more than that, I'm going to say, I'll start with what the scandal is. Then I'll get to the serious question. The scandal is really pretty simple, and I had to read a lot of articles to figure it out because it's put in a very vague way. Basically, you have payments coming.
No, but people were arrested?
No. Well, yes, there are charges are being made against
charges
people.
Are being made against like coaches.
Coaches and whatever.
And
yeah. Let me go at it another way. Okay. Let me tell you what they allege first. What they say is, in terms of what happened. What happened was that shoe companies like Adidas, in particular Adidas, and some agents shuttled money, and the money ultimately really came from Adidas, right? To certain players, getting them, incentivizing them, paying them to go to universities that had contracts with Adidas.
So they didn't just give them shoes.
No. They gave them money.
Okay.
They gave them money. They gave their families money. So let's say
they give them the money?
Through the agents. Through the agents and through the coaches, through whatever, through intermediaries. But monies go, let's call it $30,000 or $40,000 goes to a player's family. The player is then shuttled to a school like, let's call it Louisville, which was the main school. It's been mentioned so far because Louisville, all the schools have contracts with particular sneaker companies. Louisville has a contract with Adidas. All the kids on that team wear Adidas, all right? And then beyond that, there's an agreement that when the kid goes pro, he will sign a contract with Adidas. Because once you're with the pros, you're not bound to any particular team's affiliation. You can pick your own shoe. So basically, it's money from the athletic shoe companies shuttled through agents and assistant coaches to high school players who then, for receiving that money, go to particular schools and then sponsor and wear those sneakers when they're in the pros.
So somebody makes it clear to a recruit that if he signs with this school, he will get this kind of money from Adidas and
more
be
than
set
that,
for life.
And more than that, he's supposed to sign with a particular agent and he's supposed to wear a particular shoe when he's in the pros.
Okay, so. Okay.
But it's real money.
All right.
And the real question in all this, shady dealings indeed, is that illegal? And the answer is no, it's not. Why is the U.S. attorney standing there and citing all these alleged violations of the law, doing an incredible, detailed investigation? I don't know. And here's how I can tell you in the most persuasive way why it's not illegal. Here's the theory of illegality. The theory of illegality is that the universities were the victims of the alleged schemes because the universities were unaware of the alleged bribes. They gave financial aid to student athletes who were in violation of NCAA rules. That's the so-called legal violation. Yeah. In other words, you've got what people react to when they hear about this is they say, well, these are wrongful payments. The kids aren't supposed to get payments. It's secret double dealings, whatever it is. And the beneficiaries are the universities. And the so-called crime is the victims, the universities, because now they're going to be found in violation of the NCAA rules. When in fact, the universities are probably the perpetrators or whatever is going on. They're in the middle of it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how you know.
So it's not against the law, it's just against NCAA rules?
Really, that's the truth of it, yeah.
Okay.
But somehow somebody decided that this is the kind of thing that the government ought to investigate and get on the front pages and take credit for.
Well, we like to believe in, the athlete,
Again, well, let me get to that in a second.
Okay.
So my first point is, I don't understand why the U.S. attorney is involved. I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And although this happens all the time, there are all kinds of prosecutions brought for reasons nothing other than publicity.
Okay.
So it's kind of off-putting, frankly. And it's a little bit hypocritical, honestly. But let's go to the point that you say about paying money to the athlete. And that's the underlying issue. And just go ahead, finish your thought.
Well, then we like to believe that they are just doing it for love of the game and mens sana in corpore sano, the idea that, a you know, fully realized person is educated and physically fit kind of thing.
Yeah, okay.
And,
so
that, not that they are paid athletes to perform for the pleasure of alums or whatever.
Well, we may like to believe that, but that ship has sailed. But let me give you an example why. Let me give it to you from the athlete's point of view.
Yeah.
Okay, because I don't criticize the athlete for this. All right. There's a famous story involving Chris Webber. Chris Webber was one of the Fab Five of the University of Michigan some years ago, where they had five great freshmen that brought the team to national prominence and to the NCAA final.
This would be basketball.
Basketball, okay. Right? Because we're talking about basketball. And so Chris Webber is a freshman, and he's at the University of Michigan. He's from a very poor background. And I will tell you that he later became a very famous professional basketball player after 1 year at Michigan. And he's walking, but in his freshman year at Michigan, he's walking along the streets. The team's very successful by the campus, on the street right adjoining the campus, and he's with a girl, and he's saying to himself, "I don't have enough." And he sees a picture. He goes through. He sees a window, a shop window, which has jerseys. They're selling commemorative jerseys from the team, the basketball team. And he's saying to himself, "I'm with this girl. I don't have enough money to take her to the movies. I don't have enough money to buy her a hamburger." I look in the window, says Chris Webber jersey, $75.
And he's getting none of that.
And I say to myself, what's my piece of the $75?
Yeah.
And immediately after that, he broke the rules. And frankly, after they went to the finals, they were disqualified a couple of years later because they found out that he violated the rules. But his reaction was, really? Really? I'm making tons of money for this school and I don't get any of it. Is that really fair?
Right.
So that's what it comes down to.
And a scholarship to be at the school is not really enough. Cover it.
And especially these kids are what we call one and done. They spend 1 year at the school, and then they go into the pros. So what are they really getting out of the scholarship? They spend one semester in school. One semester.
Well, it is sort of a shame they don't get an education. That we'd like to believe that would help.
But that's not going to happen.
All right.
The other story quickly in sports, I'll just mention it. There was an article about Peter Norman in connection with athletic protests. And there, of course, was the famous protest in the 1968 Olympics. And
this came up in conjunction with all the kerfuffle about the NFL.
Right.
Protest during the singing of the national anthem.
Right. So that was Juan Carlos and Tommy Smith gave the Black Power salute on the platform when they received medals in the 1968 Olympics. And they faced repercussions for that afterwards. Well,
a famous picture.
It's a famous with a raised fist. But there was a third person that people forget who was on the platform, and that was the silver medalist. And that was a white athlete from Australia. Mm-hmm. And he did not raise his arm, but he did stand with them. And they spoke to him beforehand, and they explained their reasoning and what they were going to do. And he said, well, that's persuasive to me, and I'll stand with you.
And he bowed his head.
And he suffered the same kind of repercussions, it turns out, in Australia, just for bowing his head, that Juan Carlos and Tommy Smith suffered. He was the Australian record holder for the 200 meters, silver medalist. Next Olympics, they would not let him compete. He was not allowed to compete anymore in serious athletic events in Australia. He was not honored when they honored the medal winners from the 1968 Olympics some 20 years later. And when he passed away a few years ago, there's a photograph in the paper of his pallbearers, two of his pallbearers, Tommy Smith and John Carlos.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So, on a slightly different note, museum update. The Brooklyn Museum is having an exhibition of animal mummies. And this is just kind of interesting because they're, you know, Egyptian animal mummies.
Right.
And they have the mummies. They have things that, you know.
This is a little out, this is a little out there to me, I got to tell you.
Okay? And they have CT scans of the mummies. Okay. And what kind of animals did the Egyptians mummify? Well, the majority of them were things like ducks and geese.
Yeah.
And they were meant to be food for people in the afterlife.
Wow.
Because you remember that the Egyptians, you know, in their tombs,
so they're not even treasured
are models
pets or
and
like
paintings of everything they're going to need in the afterlife. All right.
Right.
But there are also, there are pets. There are the royal pets get mummified.
Right.
There is also this side business of mummies that might be sort of use, perhaps as sort of prayers or requests or, you know, kind of a sort of shout out to particular gods that are associated with various animals. And there are all kinds. Nothing's too small. You have to tell your buddy Harry, even beetles, he probably knows this, even beetles were occasionally mummified.
Right.
And shrews and ibis and cattle get mummified. But the fun thing is, so those have sort of a religious purpose.
Yeah.
And the Egyptian priests actually raise a lot of these animals. And they raise the animals, and then they have a mummification ritual, and then they will pray for the mummies. And as they're doing these CT scans that we're now able to do of these mummies, they're finding out that not all of them, not all the mummies are real mummies.
Really?
That in some cases it's just they're shaped like the mummy, but it's just a few feathers or it's just some sand and pebbles.
So people were ripped off.
Well, it's not clear if they were all ripped off or if there was like a less expensive option.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So maybe it's that, or maybe the Egyptian priests were not as honest.
As we all assumed they were.
Yes. So that's going to be on at the Brooklyn Museum until January 21st.
It's another
so that
scandal.
Might be fun to see.
Another scandal.
Another scandal.
So I saw an interesting book review in the Wall Street Journal. And I think I may read this book. And I think this is one of those rare books that you and I might both read. It's a book called An Odyssey by Daniel Mendelsohn. It's reviewed by a fellow named Bill Spiegelman. And it's a nonfiction book. It's a book by a guy who's Mendelsohn, who's a professor who teaches the Odyssey in college, in Bard College.
Right.
And he's apparently a wonderful teacher, and they go on to say he's the kind of teacher you dream about. He engages his students, et cetera, et cetera. Well, his father, who's kind of an irascible guy, who's 80 years old, he comes to the end of his career, and he decides to attend Mendelsohn's course. And his father is a man of science and a very difficult person. And what happens is he has issues with Mendelsohn about the way he teaches the Odyssey. And he also has, it turns out that they have a lot of back and forth in here. And the story is their journey. So it's sort of two narratives going on. One is the Odyssey itself is sort of a journey, obviously, itself. And you have his own
Odyssey,
journey with his dad.
We should just state, the Odyssey is the story of Ulysses after the Trojan War.
Exactly.
And working his way back
home
to Penelope.
You're right.
And seeing what is going on, has been going on in his absence, and how he deals with the journey and getting back.
Well, the review interests me. It says this: the heart of the book is fathers and sons. Sons looking for fathers, downing them, and then understanding them. Fathers challenging and also rooting for their sons. It seems fair. Daniel, who's the author, knows part of his father's story. What child ever sees a parent as well as the parent sees the child? A truth everywhere acknowledged in Mendelsohn's Odyssey is that everyone has a story, just as every hero has a flaw, and that everyone needs stories to get through life. So it just struck me as a really interesting book for no small reason, because it's a nonfiction book.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll put it on the list. And now, we're running the risk of becoming the All Sardine Podcast.
There's no risk in that. There's great pride in that.
This week, another article, quite a lot of discussion about sardines, this time in the Wall Street Journal. And the article is not even, doesn't even show a picture of sardines. It purports to be about piri-piri chicken, Portuguese way of preparing chicken that's supposed to be super delicious. There are all these piri-piri chicken places in Washington.
Places. Yeah, Washington, D.C. More than any place else, right.
But it starts off talking about Chef George Mendes. It says, when Chef George Mendes was 5, he had his first food epiphany on a trip from his Connecticut home to his parents' native Portugal. And they stop at a food festival, and he disappears. My mom lost me, said Mr. Mendes. Apparently, and this is when he's 5, I got a hold of a plate of sardines, took off, sat on a tree stump off on the side eating them. the combination of the charred skin, lemon, and oily fish was kind of an awakening for me. Yeah.
The image of this little kid in a corner eating sardines.
And being delighted. Yes,
we have a lot of pictures of our kids, but none like that.
None like that. Right. Okay. And so the writer of this article, Matthew Kronsberg, then relates his sardine experience in Portugal. After a few minutes of watching the cook's work, I followed and took a table, ordered an Imperial of Sagres beer, codfish salad, and a plate of sardines. Plump, rich, and well charred, the sardines needed only a generous squeeze of lemon and a drizzle of olive oil. And he goes on to describe eating some piri piri chicken as well, at which point the chef says, "I hope it's okay for you." He replies, "It was more than okay. I wanted to go find a tree stump and be by myself."
Oh, it's lyrical. For a while. There we go. Yeah. I'm sold.
So sardines clearly create a great experience for anyone.
All right.
And then in the Times, it's plum season, actually. And the Times was encouraging people to make their most asked for recipe of Marion Burroughs plum tart. Mm. I've actually made it. It is sort of divine, even if you're not a big plum person. It's quite a treat, so I can recommend that. And meanwhile, I've heard some distressing news about chocolate.
Well, it fits in the category of disaster is lurking around the corner, but it's going to be something that we never suspect. In this case, disaster meaning the end of chocolate. Apparently,
Costa Rica would be a disaster.
Apparently, it would be. Well, for a couple of interesting reasons. There's this, a lot of the chocolate is grown in Costa Rica. There are all kinds of moles which have been attacking the chocolate and, in fact, interfering with the crop. This is a particularly bad time because demand has been increasing for two good reasons. They're called China and India. Apparently that the people in China and India are now developing a taste for chocolate, and you can imagine that could really move the needle demand-wise. And the article in the Times is about a fellow named Wilbert Phillips Mora, who's devoted his life to developing hybrids of chocolate that will survive this mold, and he feels he's only a half a step ahead of the next mold and not getting enough funding, et cetera, et cetera. So just another thing to worry about, which would be the end of chocolate. Though we're okay,
but there's
now.
Hope.
There's hope. And speaking of hope,
people are on it.
Right. One other book I wanted to mention is a book about the Chicago Cubs by a fellow named Rich Cohen, which is reviewed by Will Leach in the Wall Street Journal.
Really, the Cubs, as in baseball?
As in baseball. We haven't talked about baseball.
And I see that I can see the title of the article from here.
Yeah.
Beautiful losers.
Right. So here's really the theme, if I can boil it down. There were two teams who, for 70 or 80 years, were unsuccessful in the major leagues. And they were the Chicago Cubs and the Boston Red Sox. And what this book speaks about, and which I've heard over the years, is that they were very different situations. The Red Sox, on the one hand, would often come close, second place to the Yankees, would strive, and the fans would agonize with their failures. So they just missed. They would just miss, and they would never make the World Series, and there was a lot of
mixed emotions. Those damn Yankees.
Yeah, damn Yankees, exactly right. The Cubs weren't that. They were never close. They were never close. They were always lagging. They were near last place. And there was a reason for this. And the reason was the owner of the team, Phil Wrigley, figured out that the people in Chicago were there for the ballgame. They're there for the experience. Mm-hmm. And as long as you had the attractive Wrigley Field with the ivy, the games were all played during the day, the team would be accepted, the team would be profitable, win or lose. And it was run that way with no particular
emphasis
on having to win. And when you don't,
I feel like I would fit in there.
Exactly right. And you don't have
it all about the experience.
Well, so here's what happens. What happens is baseball fans know is a guy named Theo Epstein, who becomes a general manager of the Red Sox and brings that team to its World Series victory finally, what they've been pining for. And then he goes, of all things, to the Cubs, and he brings that team to a victory.
He's got a magic touch.
Well, but also he has what they call in the article an East Coast sensibility. He doesn't want to know about everyone's happy in Chicago. Okay. He comes over there and says, no, I'm here to win. And they actually win. So they have a whole different approach now. And of course, if you're a Met fan, you can't help but say to yourself, isn't this what's going on in New York? The Yankees have a win-at-all-costs mentality to what I would call an annoying degree. The Mets, and I'm a Met fan, don't have that. They have a we-don't-care-if-we-win attitude to an annoying degree. And it shows up.
Is that possibly true?
It is possibly true. And that the team clearly doesn't feel the same
need. Are you sure it's not just we're not willing to spend enough to win?
I think that's kind of linked up with it, but yes. But that's it.
We could win if we wanted to, but we really don't need to.
They don't really
feel fans don't really expect it.
It really comes down to dollars and cents. The Mets have the budget of what they call a middle market team. The Mets think they should spend the same amount as the Milwaukee Brewers. And there are some people in New York and say, really? Because you're making a lot more money than the Milwaukee Brewers. How does that work?
So you get to keep more money.
That's where it lies. And I should just mention the playoffs are coming up, baseball playoffs.
Really, the baseball playoffs.
I could name every team in the playoffs, as you know, team.
I have no idea.
There are people.
Who are you picking?
Well, look, there's a lot of excitement. A lot of people say that almost any team can win. There are all these great teams. Yes and no. There are actually only a couple of three teams that can win. And I'll tell you who they are. They are.
Because we're going to hold you to this.
That's fine.
And we're going to make fun of you.
The best team in the National League. The best team in the National League is the Dodgers. The second best team is Washington, but Washington just suffered an injury yesterday with Max Scherzer. So if that holds up.
Scherzer's a pitcher?
Yes.
Okay.
And if he turns out really to be injured, there's only one team in the National League, and that's the Dodgers. So we'll see about Scherzer.
All right.
On the American League side, there's two teams, really, and they are the Houston Astros and the Cleveland Indians. And probably the team
that wins. Is that the Jay Bruce Cleveland Indians?
The Jay Bruce. Well, we have Jay Bruce stories coming up if that team goes on. Okay. So those are the only teams to focus on, and that makes it simpler for you. One final story before we get to dueling obituaries. Just a thought-provoking story about the brain surgery, because we all say whenever we run into a situation that's a little difficult and a little fraught, someone always says, well, it's not brain surgery. Well, it turns out that if you're a brain surgeon, what you actually do is brain surgery. And it's somewhat unnerving. There's an article in the journal, apropos of nothing, called The Conscience of a Brain Surgeon. It's not a book. It's just a guy who feels the need to unburn himself and talk about his difficulties. And as he puts it, you know, there's obviously a lot of technique in being a brain surgeon. But the real question is when to operate. Because if you have an aneurysm, obviously there are implications with a threatened aneurysm on the one hand, but on the other hand, any kind of
messing around,
anything that goes even a hair wrong, and there's always some risk of that, kills a person, shuts them down, and brain function wise, changes their lives. So he says he has regrets about some operations, but they're not about the way they did it. They're about the decision whether or not to operate. And that plagues him. And he says, here's the real problem. The real problem is that, you want to always become a better surgeon and learn from your experience. And the best way to do that might be to have a lot of peer review and to sit down with your peers and go over situations and review things. The problem is that to be a brain surgeon, you need a certain personality. And that personality is tremendous confidence, almost up to the feeling of omnipotence. And that means you're not really a team player. You're not really
looking for that. So it may not be a situation where a committee vote is
going to help
you.
Is the best way to go. Plus, your patient wants you to be that way. When you present yourself to the patient, they don't care if you're courteous. They want to see someone who is completely in control and has 100% confidence. So the personality type that succeeds as a brain surgeon is one that really can't take that kind of second-guessing and critical evaluation. So it's very hard to progress.
Well, I found that interesting. You were telling me a little bit about that because that's often the conflict you go through. How much do you listen to other people's opinions, and how much do you forge ahead and say, I don't care.
Right.
You know, I'm doing this. It's different. It's important. It's, you know, it's the only way you're, you know, other people are not getting it.
That's exactly right. And I think what he's saying, when you're a brain surgeon, you're better off having that kind of mindset. And frankly, that applies to athletics too. you listen to a certain extent, and you have to be committed to what you're doing.
And it applies to art and artists as well.
I guess it does.
You know, very often your art teacher says, no, you know, this is what you want to do. You've got to color in between the lines.
Right.
And the great artists are the ones
have
who
their own
break
vision.
All
have their own
those
vision.
Rules.
Absolutely right.
You know, Picasso is one of the greats in terms of that because he knew every rule. His dad was an art teacher.
Really?
And he was a tremendous. And, you know, at age 14,
yeah.
he was an incredible draftsman. I mean, he could reproduce great masters like nobody's business. But he leaves that.
Right. Well, listen, it seems that much more credible if you're going to break rules if you know the rules. And you've got to break the rules.
True.
I bet there's not a single great artist that didn't break the rules. That's what I said.
We can put that out for another
time. Okay. We now have a new section, which we'll have every once in a while. It's called Dueling Obituaries. Tamsin and I are going to do an obituary that we haven't really previewed with the other at any great length, and we'll see which is more interesting. Tamsin first.
Well, mine is titled Lady Lucan, Last Witness to Murder Most Lurid, Dies at 80.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is a story about a woman who passed away in England, okay, age 80. What happened was in 1974, her husband, she says, murdered the nanny.
Right.
Thinking he was murdering her.
Oh.
She runs into him on his way out of the basement, having murdered the nanny, and he sees
her. Why am I laughing at this?
It's just a weird story. Starts to beat her with a pipe.
Right.
She grabs him by the, excuse the expression, balls.
Right.
And gets him to stop.
Right.
They, in the British way, have a little chat.
Yeah.
And he leaves.
Yeah.
And eventually she, you know, gets the police.
Right.
So he, you know, you never see him again. And the question is, he is tried. He's found guilty.
Oh, really?
And but they have no. They don't know if he's dead. They don't know where
he is. Oh, they try him in absentia?
Yeah.
Oh my
God. Apparently, and so she can't. You know, she can't have. She can't inherit anything.
Oh, really?
She can't have custody of the kids, all because no one knows if he's dead.
Really?
He's just gone. So eventually in 1999, he is declared dead. I mean, it's a whole crazy British story because, when she marries him, he is a professional, gambler and a backgammon player.
Oh, well, there you go. Those
and
are the worst
he will
kind of
inherit his father's title as Lord Lucan.
Yeah.
His last name is Bingham.
Yeah.
And so they marry in 1963. Their honeymoon is on the Orient Express.
Oh, God.
I mean, how British is that? And so the marriage is not especially happy.
Yeah.
They have three kids. He is trying to get custody from her.
Right.
I mean, it's fraught with the difficulties, but anyway, so.
All right. Well, that is a worthy entrant.
But he is eventually declared dead and partially so that his son, George Bingham, can inherit his title.
Oh, too late for that, yeah.
And, in talking about his father, et cetera, you know, there's all kinds of, gossip and stories about the fellow. To hear that your father is a racist, a snob, a poster boy for the aristocracy in the 70s didn't sit very well with the rather charming, rather lovely, and kind man that I knew, says his son. Nevertheless, people, if they leave the party early, get to be speculated about, don't they?
As I say, a worthy entrant
into the
obituary competition. But
the quintessential leaving the party
early. Here we go. Well, my two is an obituary in which the subsidiary character has become most important. Anne Jeffries died. And the headline... Anne Jeffries, the headline says, the glamorous ghost of TV's Topper in the 1950s.
Everyone
loves Topper. Dies at 94. So just to explain, unless you'd like to explain.
No, you explain.
All right, Topper was a television series. It ran for 2 years in the late 1950s. And it was a story of two glamorous young people who had an accident and passed away. And the house came to be occupied by a
Leo
rather
G.
conservative
Carroll?
Gentleman.
Leo G. Carroll?
Played by Leo G. Carroll.
Right.
And they haunted the place. The glamorous couple haunted the place. And hilarity ensued. And it was an extremely sophisticated, witty, it was a great show.
They pestered him.
They gave him advice,
got him into scrapes.
They drive him crazy. And Leo G. Carroll was very proper and had this great sense of propriety.
Does it say when that was on TV?
They have the years here somewhere, as I say. It's the late 50s.
I only saw reruns, I think.
Right. No, I think we all saw reruns.
Okay.
But here's the funny thing.
Black and white.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Who do you think wrote Topper?
I have no idea.
You want to take a wild guess? It's someone very famous.
No. Isaac Bashevis Singer?
No. That's an excellent but incredibly wrong guess. The answer is Stephen Sondheim.
No.
Yes.
That's not even possible.
It's possible and it's true.
He wasn't old enough. How is he old enough?
He had just finished studying music with Milton Babbitt and somehow he got a job.
No, that cannot be possible.
Samson, Daniel,
you're making this up.
I'm not making it up. And
somebody has pulled one over.
It's in
the
Times. I can read it to you. No, I checked it out myself. He wrote most of the episodes and was the head writer for the Topper for 2 years.
That man is a genius. That man is a genius.
Oh, there's more though. I'm going deep on this.
Oh my God. Okay.
So here's something funny. Topper is so popular that at one point in the late 1990s, they were going to make a musical of it. And it got all the way to Broadway, I think, but was terribly unsuccessful. Sondheim didn't write the music for the musical, but here's what's interesting. The lead character, the Leo G. Carroll part, was played by Ron Holgate. Do you know who Ron Holgate is?
Nope.
Okay, here you go. Ron Holgate was the Broadway actor who played Henry Lee in 1776 and sang that great song about the leaves.
Really?
For which, I should tell you, he won a Tony Award, even though he had almost no dialogue by that song. But I'm going to tell you something else which is really going to floor you.
That is a great song.
He had one other major Broadway part, and it was before that. And that other Broadway part was in the original cast of Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum by Stephen Sondheim. And
suitalist?
He played
he wasn't
one Milos Gloriosus.
We're laughing because that's a favorite family song.
Favorite family
we
song.
We have great memories of the Honorable Zeke Abuhoff
singing
as like a 5-year-old.
Right.
Singing in the outdoor shower
right.
in Block Island, I, Milos Gloriosus.
Right. And so Zeke, just to make it worse, he had only one very recent Broadway musical part, and that was in a show that you, Zeke, saw, which was Annie Get Your Gun with Bernadette Peters, and he played Buffalo Bill Cody.
Really?
Yes. So it all comes back to Sondheim, in this case, a sideways glance to Ron Holgate. That, I think we can say, is the winning obituary of this week. And thanks
all.
For joining us.
That's
Hampton
all.
Dan, read
can't
the papers.
Top that.
Yes, can't top that.